twice a week, Van Lathan and Rachel Lindsay dissect the biggest topics in Black culture, politics, and sports on their show, Higher Learning. They discuss the most important and timely conversations while also frequently inviting guests on the podcast and occasionally debating each other. Check out Higher Learning on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. If you've had it with your overpriced wireless plan with its insanely high monthly bill and unexpected overages, then listen to this. For a limited time, wireless plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. That's unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. Wow, right? To get this new customer offer, just go to mintmobile.com/watch. That's mintmobile.com/watch. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speed slower, above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for more details.
This episode is brought to you by Empower. You got money questions like, can I retire early? What are my best savings options? Can I afford to pay for my kids' education? Luckily, Empower has all the answers. With Empower's real-time dashboard and real live conversations, you get clarity on your real-life financial goals. So join 18 million Americans and Empower what's next. Start today at empower.com. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more. Sponsored by Empower, not an endorsement or a statement of satisfaction by a client.
I need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at TheRinger.com, and joining me on the other line, Dane Whitman on the streets, Icarus in the sheets, it's Andy Griffold! Woo!
Just trying to parse that.
Yeah, there's a lot to break down, man. Today, we're going to talk a little bit about the Eternals in the second half of the show.
A
lot about the Eternals in the second half of the show.
Be honest with the people, Chris. Be honest.
You know we had to bless these heads with our MCU takes, right?
I'm so eager. I can't remember the last time I've been this excited to talk about a movie I saw in the theater, mainly because I hadn't seen a movie in the theater in 21 months.
Greenwald, there's a little bit of stuff I want to get to. I'm feeling great. I got nothing but Moderna pumping through the system right now. I got boosted. I'm doing
this. Chris is on a tear right now.
Ice in veins injection, like gestures to everybody I see.
Chris, you white knuckled it with the sugar pill shot for like 7.5 months. You were just in the world, just vulnerable. You know what I mean?
I know.
You never wavered. I never saw you shake. I was impressed. But now
I was good, man. Shout out to J&J. Shout out to the homies at Moderna. We're coming back. Andy, you want to know why I also have a little bit of pep in my step?
Tell me.
It's Chrissapalooza. It's my Burning Man right now. You wake up one day and you're like, yeah, you know what? What is there to watch right now? And then you find out it's all there. It's all there, and it's just for you. It was made for you. So right now, I'm just like overwhelmed with love for the world because I've got Yellowstone and I've got Narcos Mexico season 3, and I'm just going back and forth. I got my guy Casey Dutton out there on the highways on Yellowstone. I've got Walt Breslin, played by Scoot McNairy. Just the DEA of El Paso is strong out here in Narcos Mexico season 3. It's a great time to be me. It's a great time to be alive and watching television. I can't wait to talk about it with you.
You also, It's almost election day, and we're going to elect a new mayor of Kingstown. I'm not sure if you're aware of that. You know, Curtis Sliwa has run a good race, but I do think
that's right.
Mayor Jeremy Renner is going to take it. And I have to say,
I think Kyle Chandler is the mayor, isn't he?
You know what, Chris?
I can't wait to find out.
You'll have to tell me. I just wanted to point out that, you know, this is, we often cite this, which is a key, you know, this is really a window into our finger on the pulse vision of the world. But you guys remember, everybody remembers how the New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman would be like, my taxi driver in Mumbai commented to me that his recent smartphone caught, and then he'll extrapolate like at least a month's worth of columns off of that. That's how I feel about the billboards here in our city of Los Angeles. And, you know, you can kind of tell which billboards are up for ego management. You can tell which are up for seasonality. Obviously, there were a lot of Halloween horror movies up recently.
You commented on that.
I would like to particularly shout out the pornography company that has decided to really big boy its game up and purchase, apparently in perpetuity, the billboard that we pass when arriving at my daughter's school every day. So that's a fun one.
I got to tell you, I'm a little concerned about the billboard industry because I was driving down, I think Melrose or maybe Beverly the other day, and there's just a giant billboard for a mall in Miami. And it's like, hey, you coming to Miami? check out Balfour Grove. And it's just like a really great mall in Miami.
That's interesting. So you're suggesting that the billboards that I'm seeing are less a window into the relative robustness and health of the particular industry being advertised and more a savage indictment of our failing billboard economy. Thanks, Sleepy Joe. That's what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying,
If these Democratic centrists would get off their ass, we could save the billboard industry. That's
what I want from my billboards. I think that billboards should pivot to algorithmic advertising the way, like, when you get to the bottom of, like, an actual article on, like, ESPN or something, and then at the bottom, it's like, find out why your teeth are about to fall out. You know, six ways to use peas, you know,
that would definitely increase car accidents, though, wouldn't it? Because they're like, here's something you need to find out, but wait till you get home or park. But so all I wanted to say is, and you've thrown a curveball here, as you so often do. It's why you're the best at what you do, why you're my mayor of Kingstown always. But I thought prior to beginning this monologue that I had some sense of these things. So, like, for example, I feel relatively certain that I know where the showrunner of the Paramount Plus program Guilty Party lives.
Okay.
I don't know anything about the show. I don't know who the showrunner is. But judging by where the billboard is, I think I know where the showrunner lives.
Okay.
Okay.
You don't have to blow up that person's spot. Yeah.
No. God bless. That said, the mayor of Kingstown, coming from your boy, Taylor Sheridan, starring your other boys, Jeremy Renner and Kyle Chandler, and your forever queen of Kingstown or Queen of Queenstown, Diane Wiest. That show is clearly something else because from a certain vantage point coming down Highland from the Hollywood Bowl, there's not one billboard for it. There's not two billboards for it. There are three complementary billboard pieces in different parts of the heart of Hollywood celebrating this show.
They do that sometimes on Sunset where you'll be driving and it'll like the billboards were almost like they'll either tell a story or there's so many cast members they are contractually required to feature on the billboard that like the final season of Lucifer has like three billboards on Sunset because they've got like nine people who had it written into their deal. I'm above Sunset, baby.
And Zendaya is Michi, which is still, you know, the great defining thing of our time. I'm very happy for you. I do feel like I ought to strap on my stirrups and watch some of this hyper-masculine programming with you.
I'd like you to watch Mayor of Easttown. It's a tough ask to be like, get into Yellowstone
Kingstown.
Season 4.
Kingstown.
I'd like you to watch Kingstown with me.
Right.
It's a tough ask to get in on Yellowstone 4 seasons in, although it's the most popular show on cable.
I mean, that is where this is. I'll check some out. I would love to talk to you about it. But just from an outsider perspective, it's really hard to even put into context how insane these numbers are. That Yellowstone is a basic cable show. Mm-hmm. It is on Paramount Network.
That is near impossible to stream.
Like it is, yes.
Because the previous seasons are on Peacock, but the next day you have to have the Paramount app to watch Yellowstone, I believe, with commercials.
8 million people watched the premiere. Now, I'm not saying that I know a thing or two about trying to debut a series on basic cable when it's not available on streaming the next day or indeed for a year and a half. I'm not saying I know anything about that, but 8 million people is an insane number. I mean, that is a hit show, the likes of which we don't really fathom. And I will also say, and we've mentioned it before, but I feel like it's worth coming back to, it's not always easy to pinpoint like the most crucial inflection points in an industry's shift while they're happening in real time. But I do believe that the previous regime at Paramount's decision to sell the streaming rights of Yellowstone to Peacock will be looked at. It will be studied. It will be written about in books.
So,
because the ripple effect of all of this is so wild, there will never be a deal like that again, ever.
Is it similar to the quote unquote, the decision that AMC made to, I mean, like AMC obviously didn't have the infrastructure at the time to start a streaming service to show Breaking Bad on their service. But is it akin to that? Is it akin to AMC offloading all of their streaming rights to Netflix and then finding out
question.
That most people thought Breaking Bad was a Netflix show?
It's a great question. No, because Breaking Bad is not an AMC show. Breaking Bad is a Sony show.
Gotcha.
That is also from the older world. And Sony, at this point, I mean, they certainly build themselves this way. They're like the last major independent standing. They do not have a streaming service, which on the one hand gives them some exciting flexibility. On the other hand, really, really, really puts them in jeopardy because they don't have a natural home for things. And now they have to fight twice as hard to elbow out of the way the in-house products. Yellowstone, as we said, massive, massive hit. The kind of hit that can not just sustain a more traditional cable network, but can absolutely be the foundation to build a successful streaming service. Paramount Plus wants to be a successful streaming service. It doesn't have its blue chip player. It farmed it out. It's playing in Europe. It's such a wild thing. And that will never happen again. I mean, these services, these studios are going to, if they're lucky enough to make a hit, they're keeping that in-house all the way across the board. And you could argue that the Taylor Sheridan verse, I mean, he made a hit show. He's going to get rewarded. He's going to get more opportunities. But it is in some ways, I don't want to say an overreaction, but it is definitely a reaction to losing Yellowstone, where they're like, we're just going to have him pump out as many other Yellowstones as possible to keep the vibe, to keep the connections. We understand that Paramount Network and Paramount Plus are related, and also to hopefully catch fire one more time and bring those 8 million eyeballs onto our streaming service.
So Kingstown is on Sunday night, and on the season opener of Yellowstone, there was not one, but two essentially backdoor pilots. Now, one was a scene that was thematically coherent with the episode of Yellowstone, but was essentially a scene from 1883, which is the Yellowstone origin story set in the Wild West with Tim McGraw and Sam Elliott. And then later Yellowstone, there was, without giving anything away, a character is asked to go to Texas to work on a new horse ranch, which will be, I think it's called the Four Sixes.
The reverse Lonesome Dove.
It is the reverse Dove.
A very rarely seen move. Very good.
So, and then there's, I believe, he's also got like an oil baron show coming. So he's busy. You know, it'll be interesting to see what his creative involvement can be in all of these things. He still is the sole credited writer for every episode of Yellowstone. And so
wild.
And I was reading an interview with him where he was talking about how there was one point during the season 4 production of Yellowstone where he was like sleeping till 2, would write an episode of Yellowstone, and then would go shoot Those Who Wish Me Dead at night.
I mean, look, if you love what you do, you never work a day in your life.
That's true.
There are people out there. We've met one, our buddy Chuck Losterman. There are people out there who love writing. They love it. It's fun for them. I think these people are insane. Yeah. And I've been a professional writer for 22 years. But yeah, there are people like that. He might be one of them.
Aaron Sorkin also loves writing.
Aaron Sorkin loves language.
Let's talk about Aaron Sorkin, because you hit me up. You were like, did you see this Being Ricardo's trailer? And I did. And I'm going to see this movie, just like I see everything that Aaron Sorkin does, because I'm just a big fan of his writing, as we both know. But you seemed like you had just been hit in the head with a sack of potatoes when this happened.
Well, I was really perplexed by it, you know. It's funny, and I don't know if this is just the way my brain worked as a critic, or it's a factor of being on this podcast, or it's just a sort of natural allergy to Sorkin's project writ large. But I did watch this trailer. It's an Amazon original film now, right? So it will be on Amazon Prime when it debuts. Two Oscar winners, Nicole Kidman and Javier Bardem, playing Lucy and Ricky in a lovingly recreated period piece about making I Love Lucy show and some turbulent times in their marriage, et cetera, et cetera. But I definitely saw this trailer with a very cynical industry eye, where I watched this and I was like, I'm sorry, excuse me, who is this for? That's not a great question to ask. I apologize. I think it's they all chase their muse, and it looks like the production detail is amazing, and J.K. Simmons is going to be great as what's his name? The other guy. sorry, TV historians. But like, I want to be clear about something, and I don't want to put Kaya on the spot, but I did want to ask Kaya a question here, which is, Kaya, have you ever watched?
Okay, it's Kaya.
You gave, as her legal guardian, you are Cersei to her Sprite. Kaya, have you ever watched an episode of I Love Lucy? Do you have opinions about this subject matter in particular?
No, and no, I'm sorry.
So when I you do not need to apologize, and I'm not. I'm just curious if when we say Lucy and Ricky, if this has any like cultural currency for you. Or does the fact that this is a high class, fancy people making this movie make it interesting as a historical, historical document for you? Potentially.
I mean, I definitely have knowledge of I Love Lucy. Like, there's the scene, and I think it was a chocolate factory, right?
Yeah, she's popping them in, and
you know, I have cultural knowledge of I Love Lucy.
This isn't gotcha. I knew that you, as a smart person in the world, had cultural awareness of it. But I guess does it? Are you like, oh, great, I can't wait to learn more about the lady eating the chocolates on the line? Like, what does this represent to you?
What does this represent? I mean, it's just...
I think you already answered it with that exasperated sigh. That is, I believe, the reaction a large percentage of the people have when Aaron Sorkin settles down to teach us something. That's generally my feeling.
It represents to me yet another movie where Nicole Kidman wears a bad wig.
Some prosthetics, I think.
Yeah.
Here's the case for it. Right?
It's just bizarre to me.
Aaron Sorkin loves the dawn of the golden age of the invention of television. I mean, it's referred to, you know, even on Sports Night, you know, there's the famous William Macy monologue about the invention of TV. It's obviously a time period that fascinates him. By all accounts, he's taking several years worth of like narrative developments, I guess, and compressing them into like a week. So it's another one of his kind of Steve Jobs-esque like tricks where he's going to just make everything happen in just a matter of days. And I think it's going to be something that tells us a lot about how we live now. Probably not, but I'll tell you who he's making it for. When you're like, who is he making this for? Making it for older Academy voters.
Right.
They will love this. They will love the movie star aspect of it. They will love the tribute to their industry. They will love feeling seen, I guess. I don't know. I mean, I think it definitely will, as long as it doesn't get like roasted, I could definitely see Nicole Kidman getting nominated, Javier Bardem getting nominated, Sorkin getting nominated. So strap in, man.
I think he could see that too. You know what? I might be a little bit bitter because this was supposed to be Cate Blanchett. Who I think I would be much more interested.
Was it really supposed to be her?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
She was announced.
Anything else you wanted to hit before we get into Eternals? Did you want to talk a little bit about? Oh, did you see the Stranger Things trailer?
I did.
Yeah. You excited? Excited for these kids to enter deep late puberty?
Did not recognize any of them.
When did you get off the Stranger Things train?
Season 3 was released, I think, when I was in Albuquerque in production. Yeah. So I watched some of it, but I just realized as I was watching the trailer, I'd never finished it. So it was not for lack of... I didn't not watch it intentionally. I was watching it, and then I kind of forgot.
Season 4 was shot somewhat in Albuquerque.
Great.
Yeah, so you got that going for you. I am excited for this. The Stranger Things trailer that we're referring to sets the action, at least in the beginning, in California. Millie Bobby Brown's character is in high school, I presume, and she's going back to visit Mike for spring break, and that's when I guess it's all going to pop off. But it looks cool. Like, I think that my whole thing with Stranger Things was always like that the Mayu was more interesting than the story. Like, I was always more interested in this kind of anthology of 80s pop cultural gestures than I was the story of like what's happening in the Upside Down with the Demogorgon. But, you know, different strokes.
You think some people are like deep into Demogorgon fanfic?
Yeah. You know what? Fucking Chloe Zhao is deep into some Demogorgon fanfic. You want to get into the Eternals and talk about these
I'm
Celestials
so
and Deviants? All right.
I'm so excited to talk about this movie.
Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll talk about the Eternals. This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. If you've had it with your overpriced wireless plan with its insanely high monthly bill and unexpected overages, Then listen to this. For a limited time, wireless plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. That's unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. Wow, right? To get this new customer offer, just go to mintmobile.com/watch. That's mintmobile.com/watch. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for more details.
This episode is brought to you by Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Loom help power the collaboration needed for teams to accomplish what would otherwise be impossible alone. Because individually we're great, but together we're so much better. That's why millions of teams around the world, including 75% of the Fortune 500, trust Atlassian software for everything from sports exploration and green energy to delivering pizza and podcasts. Whether you're a team of 200, or 2 billion, Atlassian software is built to help keep you connected and moving together as one. This episode is brought to you by UGG. Y'all know UGG is a brand that athletes wear all the time in the tunnel and on travel days. Well, I bet you think UGG season is only during the colder months of the year. Au contraire, you're wrong. You need to check out the latest spring drop from UGG. They have everything from sandals to clogs. I like the sandals. UGG has you covered for your next spring adventure. Shop the Golden Collection at UGG.com. This episode is brought to you by Lincoln and the all-new 2024 Nautilus Hybrid, featuring a customizable 48-inch panoramic display, available Revel audio system, and available perfect position front seats with active motion massage. Oh my God. The world isn't wide enough. Visit Lincoln.com to learn more. Some models, trims, and features may not be available or may be subject to change. Check with your local retailer for current information. Lincoln and Nautilus are trademarks of Ford or its affiliates.
All right, Andrew. MCU is back. The Eternals is upon us. The lowest Rotten Tomatoed Marvel movie in,
in how dare you?
God knows how long. Directed by Oscar winner Chloe Zhao. You know, starring Richard Madden, Gemma Chan, Kit Harington on FaceTime. We're going to do a spoilered conversation about this because I'm very excited to do so. Brian Tyree Henry, obviously also in this movie. Let's just start general. Let's start big picture. What did you think?
What a ride I had with this movie. And one of the reasons why I am so excited to talk to you about it is because I did a 180 on it midway, which is very rare. I think you know, and listeners know, that when I am out on something early, whether it is stubbornness or pride or whatever, I tend to stay out. And it's hard to imagine being more out on something than I was in the first 20 to 40 minutes of this 2-hour and 40-minute film.
What was the first thing that you were watching where you were like, oh shit, like I'm done?
What ancient Mesopotamia looked like. You know, so literally the dawn of time is when I stepped out.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, oh no. And I started, like the artisans in the earlier generations of the Whitman family, I was crafting with stones and cursed metals and rocks, crafting my takes like blades and what I was going to say. Yeah. And frankly, one of them, I before we get into what to me it was a shocking, shocking turn that left me not just weirdly fond of the movie, but I do think more emotionally engaged at times with it in the second half than I think I have been in maybe any Marvel content.
Okay.
This is a journey that you guys are going on, so buckle up. But I did want to say one thing at the top just in terms of how to frame the conversation, because there's some things I want to, some juicy, juicy morsels I want to really get into, and some things that, you know, I'm really positive about. And I think that the thought that I kept having at the beginning was, maybe I have this thought all the time. I think you might as well, Chris. I was bemoaning the fact that we live in such an awful binary time.
Mm-hmm.
Because I want to say at the top, I just think we're not equipped, not just this podcast or podcasts in general, but just a Rotten Tomatoes, Twitter, hot take, instant reaction, box office universe, we're really not in a place where we can have a discussion that says, that holds two things to be true at once, which is, I just think it is objectively good that the largest corporation and entertainment conglomerate in the world did something this fucking weird.
Sure.
And entrusted it to an Oscar-winning young woman of color to direct with a cast this diverse and interesting and unexpected, and allowed it to go where it was going to go. Some places good, some places less good. I just think that is objectively a good thing for the world.
Uh-huh.
It is also possible that when you support that, it can go all the way the fuck off the rails and produce something that I was going to say is, and instead I'm going to qualify by saying is, at times, insanely, almost ludicrously incomprehensible, if not kind of bad at times. And even worse, I think an extension of this kind of binary culture that we're in is that the swings that we get are all $500 million all in with production and promotion swings. You know what I mean? So you can't just be like, not just from a, I mean, I'm not a stakeholder in the Walt Disney Company. I don't care what they do with their money, but the stakes of everything is enormous. And then it's either celestial or deviant, you know? Eternal or deviant. And if there's one thing we learn from the movie, things evolve, man.
Yeah.
Nobody's just one thing. Everybody's a little bit of everything else. So that was what I was crafting before the Eternals took the detour to suburban wherever the fuck to visit Fastos and his human family. And Brian Tyree Henry's face about protecting his son. And I was like, holy shit, I love them? I love the Eternals?
You loved,
what is happening?
You loved just the fact that it humanized like a godlike character? Was it that it tapped into your own protective instincts as a parent? Like, what do you think it was that got you?
There was something, God, there's just, I mean, it's very hard to scale something this enormous. There are so many little pathways and cul-de-sacs I want to talk about, like Kit Harington on FaceTime, like Angelina Jolie delivering one of the strangest movie star performances in the history of movie stars. But there was something, and it's odd to say this, I mean, the cast of this movie is enormous, and yet no one is in it other than the people who are in it. You know, there are no, other than like early Mesopotamia and like Tenochtitlan, like there are no, we don't see humanity. We don't see people or places we recognize, really. It's just beautiful vistas in the Canary Islands or whatever. But there was something.
They have a fun night out in London in the beginning, you know?
See, it doesn't end well.
No.
Does not end super well. There was something about where it ended up that I felt was weirdly vulnerable and tender and kind of human and emotional in a way that isn't normal for these movies. It kind of went places. And it's not, and that the early headlines, you know, like, oh, the first Marvel movie with a sex scene. It's like, okay, is that what that was?
Have you guys
that's
seen
nice.
Sex before?
Yeah. Like, yeah, it was, yes. If you are Steve Carell and 40-year-old virgin, then please enjoy a movie sex scene. Bravo. But not so much that, but just something kind of, I don't know, broken and vulnerable about the actors and the performances and the choices they were making. It really kind of affected me. And I've had a longer Eternals hangover than I've had about any other Marvel movie, which, you know, even the ones that I've adored sat, you know, and had a great time, so much fun. I do not think about them the next day. I do not rewatch them. I've been thinking about aspects of Eternals for 3 days now.
Do you chalk that up to the fact that it's the biggest game in town right now? Or do you think that there's something inherently in the Chloe of it all that makes you feel this way?
And this is another thing that I wanted to get at. I truly and honestly do not know. The Chloe of it all is fascinating because, you know, I am an admirer of her other films, but, you know, when we talked about Nomadland, it left me kind of cold. So I don't necessarily know if she is the one who warmed up a cold genre. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think that when, again, in terms of easy binaries, this idea that Marvel as a celestial-sized monolith is interested in stamping out bloodless product and it took Chloe struggling against the machine from within to give it a little bit of feeling. I'm not sure if that's true. I just think she knows how to light Angelina Jolie on a beach, you know? And I mean, she obviously knows more than that, but she does that really well. I'm not entirely sure what it was. Maybe on a super meta level, it was that feeling of failure and falling that was kind of shot through this movie. It didn't feel like a superhero itself, you know, like even, you know, the lesser ones, whether it's Ant-Man or Captain Marvel or whatever, like there's a feeling by the time they come out of post, there's an aura of inevitability to them. You don't really see the cracks. They just roll.
Mm-hmm.
And this one does not roll. It sprawls and lurches, you know, and there's just something that I found very, as much as a movie this expensive can be, I found weirdly handmade about it. And maybe that is Chloe. I don't really know.
I wonder whether or not some of that handmade feeling is whatever the collision is between, and let's put Chloe as a quotes, because who knows, like, I mean, every single frame of this movie might be hers. And just the same way with every Marvel filmmaker, there's always the feeling like, oh, well, these fight scenes are ultimately, you know, done by like a second unit that Marvel has in house. But like, I will say that the fight scenes in Eternals, while I could care less about who was fighting because they were essentially fighting demon dogs, I thought that they were different than, say, the fight scenes in Captain America Civil War. They actually did seem a lot more like some of the Zack Snyder like action sequences from Man of Steel, which Chloe has talked about being an admirer of. I did not care for this movie. Like, I didn't feel the sense of entertainment. I didn't feel any sense of entertainment, but I also didn't really feel any kind of like emotional connection to it. I don't really want to be like, this movie sucked. What I want to talk about is how it was an interesting confrontation of the idea that, you know, we always talk about there's so much room to play inside of this sandbox. So like, there's like all this room for formal innovation and people should get weird. And I want to see the Star Wars about like, you know, lawyers hanging out at a bar in Tatooine or something like that. Like, we want to see like the procedural version of this or the detective version of that. And I think I do. But what Eternals taught me was that maybe I'm a little bit more cinematically conservative when it comes to these movies than I thought I was. And that there are certain things that previous Marvel movies, as recently as Shang-Chi, do that I think Eternals skipped past or decided to do differently. That I was like, oh, it turns out I actually don't like sad wooden performances by the central characters. Like, I do want Simu Liu and Awkwafina to be kind of joking with each other for an hour and a half before they fight. And Richard Madden and Gemma in like the sort of central romance of the movie, I was like, this is like watching like tree bark grow or something. Like, I can't believe how like staid this is. And so
it's weird. There's a collision there. You mentioned Zack Snyder and you were right too, I think. And that dividing line between DC and Marvel is real, that the DC heroes, by and large, are, Batman aside, are gods. Mm-hmm. And the Marvel heroes are, you know, kids from Queens. Right. And they have different, just very, very different vibes and themes and tenor and energy because of that. And this was a tough one because I think that what seemed to appeal to Chloe's directorial sense was the godlike grandeur of it. You know, this is on the highest possible level. These are actually more powerful beings, it would seem, than Thor, who is a god. You know what I mean? And yet, whether it was her own interest in it or the Marvel mandate, there's a scene where they're drinking, you know, hooch, talking about who's going to lead the Avengers. And that felt as natural as me riding a unicycle down Sunset Boulevard. Like, that was just, what are we even doing here? And similarly, there are moments when you can imagine what this movie could have been if it was truly, you know, as a company, if Marvel was ready to commit to a different vision for this level of its storytelling. And for me, that's essentially the insane grandeur of Jack Kirby, the legendary comic book artist and creator's vision. Mm-hmm. You know, the way that if you Google Jack Kirby Celestials or Jack Kirby Eternals and you see the artwork, it is not like anything else you can ever imagine. It is tactile and enormous and disturbing almost in its scale and size. And So there's a celestial in this movie. I mean, that's crazy to me. I love that part of the Marvel Universe, but it's a little bit dimmed from the true insanity of it. You know, I felt like watching this movie, the way to commit to that, and maybe even to commit to like the Kubrickian nature of it that maybe appealed to Chloe Zhao would, okay, show people fishing in Mesopotamia and then show a god with lasers coming out of his eyes hovering over the horizon. But it's a Marvel movie. We have to have our hands held. So we have to have a Chiron explaining. And then we see a spaceship. And then we see them arriving. And then we see them smiling. And then we see like characters speaking colloquial contemporary English and making references to wristwatches in 6000 BC. It steps on itself before sure. It can ever truly achieve flight. And I think that that collision between what it could be but what it needed to be. And again, I'm not entirely sure if that's Chloe versus Feige or not. That's just the nature of this. That was very frustrating in the beginning to me because we ended up in a nowhere place for a long time.
It also felt like they were trying to do the first Avengers movie, Civil War and Endgame in one movie.
So much to get
through. This was one of the most, and Sean and Joanna talked a little bit about this on their pod about it on The Big Picture, but like how mystery dependent or how twist dependent the plot is. And to the extent that that explains Richard Madden's performance for 2/3 of the movie, that like, why is this guy so uptight? Like, and just like seems so unable to like exhibit any emotion when, I mean, I understand they've been alive for eons, so maybe they're not like cracking up and crying and all that stuff. But, you know, even if you ascribe some of it to, well, he's going to eventually betray all these people, or he's the only one who understands their true mission other than Salma Hayek, so that's why he's acting this way. It just doesn't make for entertaining movie watching when that's happening, you know? And if Barry Keoghan and these other people and Kumail are going to have so much personality, it's hard to have the center be so statuesque, you know?
There are too many people, you know? I get why on some level, but actually, you know what? Let me stop there. I don't know why. Are there so many people because what was central to the idea was, you know, seeding the story, seeding the Marvel Universe with a lot more powerful people? Was it, we need to make more toys? I mean, I don't know. Because if you cut 3 or 4 Eternals, and it's about a family of 4 or 5 people, then suddenly there's more room for any of them to be people. You know, mm-hmm. It just fundamentally was a strange choice to do that. And then you could feel the strangeness almost triple when you get to the final collision. And I don't know if it was COVID or personal choice or what, but Kumail pieces out in the final battle.
Yeah.
That is so, so weird, right? Has anyone reported on why that is? Why a character who is built up, and deservedly so, as this is a fan favorite, this is going to pop.
Kingo?
You know. But then in the final battle, he's like, no, thank you. I will not be here for this. And when the resolution of the final battle hinges on something taken from the comics called the Unimind, when all of the Eternals like all kind of join the same 5G network briefly. So theoretically, Kingo was doing that too in his private jet, but he wasn't there for it. What?
There's some what in there. You know, just to go back to what I was saying though briefly about thinking maybe I've decided I'm a little bit more conservative in this than I thought, cinematically speaking. There's that whole sequence in the Amazon where the Eternals have gotten back together, or they're starting to get the band back together, and they've got to go find Druig, who was my favorite character in the movie, and they go find Barry Keoghan.
I knew that. I called that.
And they're going to find Barry Keoghan in the Amazon where he's, I don't know, got building like a new society or something of mind control.
He's a little Jim Jonesy down there.
Yeah, a little bit. And most of that sequence is shot in some kind of magic hour, either dawn or dusk. It's hard to tell.
It was not magic.
And it goes on for 25 minutes, and it is essentially like monochrome jungle green with
so
natural
dark.
Light. And it features 2 or 3 very long conversations and then a fight between the Eternals and some deviants. And I was watching and I was like, oh, this is why they shoot this shit in Atlanta. Like, this is why, even though it like looks ugly to my like eye, everything is sort of discernible when you have, if you're going to have 12 superheroes fighting, do it on a like airplane landing strip so everybody can see who's who and what's happening. That being said, there were moments in those sequences, like when Icarus is fighting one of those demons, and I was like, yo, legitimately, it looks like Icarus is about to die. And it it kind of like, it does throw you off of your, like, because I think I kind of tune out when fight scenes happen in Marvel, because I'm like, well, what's, nothing's going to happen here. You know what I mean? Like, I found myself like a kind of uncertainty creeping in, which I thought was very welcome, but it kind of got wiped away with, like, you know, this, it's really distracting, a lot of like the stuff that they're doing. Like, you have Angelina Jolie and you essentially do what they did to Renner in the first Avengers, where they're like, you have mind control and don't speak for the entire movie. Like, that's really strange.
Yeah. Well, I want to go beat by beat here. I noted the same thing. That was the low point of the movie for me. It was just so dark and hard to tell what was going on. But I think that the feeling of danger and risk does make a difference. We don't know these characters, but yet we have an assumption that some of them will be chum. That does change your relationship to the fighting scenes that you're seeing. I think that the deviant thing, well, first of all, it did give us one good thing, which is I have spent some time this week just thinking about the moment when it crossed Bob Chapek's desk that the Walt Disney Company now owns the trademark for the term deviant. I think that that is exciting and a little worrying for some of the rough trade shops that are on, you know, in Sunset and Silver Lake. Like, I don't know if they now have to have, like, you know, goofy.
I think those are all
whatever
acai bowl places now. You don't have to worry about it.
The deviants, and I say this politely, suck. That sucked.
Yeah.
It was dumb and it sucked and it didn't go anywhere. Like, I understand that that's...
They just, we just had this problem with Shang-Chi, but like, they had Tony Leung. You know what I mean? Like, they had an actual, like, oh, I have like a, I can see this person. Yeah, right.
I don't care how much time you spend in R&D designing cool looking metal organic wolves, but it's just not interesting. And ultimately, I think this maybe speaks to Sean and Joanna's point of too many secrets. Shout out the great film Sneakers. Ultimately, where this went as a moral conversation slash free-for-all fight between themselves, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But then you still had the Diamond Dogs running after them and mutating and then talking to them. And then I thought it was actually going to be about how they're not supposed to be enemies. They were just bred to be enemies, but they can evolve into something else. But we needed to give Angelina something to do, so she still has to kill them. That was just so poorly chosen and uninteresting and felt like groupthink from the top. And frankly, like the Chitauri aliens in the first Avengers movie served the same purpose.
All the little Ultrons in Ultron are the same way. Like, they've always got red shirts to get rid of, but like, usually there is some sort of face to the evil.
And it did lead me to a place that I ended up in, which I was shocked about. And we'll talk about this, I think, in more detail momentarily, which is, boy, I can't wait till we get through this first movie so there can be another one where it could be interesting. I think Marvel movies and, you know, series-based long-form cinematic storytelling, that's a problem they have, where the first one feels like, okay, we're introducing 100 people, but trust me, you'll like them later. That's always going to be a problem. But this brings me to the Angelina Jolie of it, which we have to carve out some space for.
Sure.
I was wrong when I said that the Fastos thing was my entry point, because I thought Don Lee as Gilgamesh was great. And the fact that the quote unquote strongest character devotes his endless, well, so we thought, life to taking care of the woman that he respects was cool. That was a very odd and tender relationship and one that I really enjoyed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I am so fucking befuddled by Angelina Jolie's performance in this. It is like, I mean, what if you had a decent paycheck job and you paid your bills with the money earned from your toil and took a modest vacation, stayed in a, you know, motel every year or whatever, but your house was full of fucking rubies and someone came over one day and was like, hey, what's up with these rubies? Why are they in your guest bedroom? And you'd be like, oh, I don't know. I don't know what to do with them, but they sure are pretty.
Right.
That's where we are here. Because, Chris, I don't watch as many movies as you do, certainly as many as Sean does. I don't know the number here, but I would have to wager there are not 10, how many movie stars do we have? Not like the great actors, but the ones who have so much fucking charisma in the tips of their fingers that your eyeballs turn to them no matter what they're doing. We do not have 10. Maybe we have 5 or 6. She's one of them. She's absolutely one of them. She looked incredible in this movie, just throwing looks and giving attitude and occasionally summoning, like, you know, golden shields and blades. And her plot line is she gets a little forgetfully sometimes and needs to take a nap. What are we doing, guys? Why are we wasting a national resource here?
Part of it might be because she basically was like, can I be in this movie? And they were
Is that the case?
That is, according to the screenwriters, they were like, Angelina wants to be in the movie. So I don't know whether they were like, it's too late. Maybe she couldn't be Cersei. I don't even know what that's just speculation. But they were like, she's Thena. We're going to give her 3 lines, but she's going to be in all the scenes.
That was the other piece of it. I was like, okay, maybe she'll Kit Harington it and be like, hey, other Eternals, sorry, something came up, but I'll zoom in, you know, for the group meetings.
Right.
But she's sitting there in Barry Keoghan's church in the Amazon, just sitting there.
Petting a lizard. Yeah.
Maybe she's just a cool hang. It was really bizarre because she's great. She's a superhero. You know what I mean? Like that was a good thing about the movie, but the weird fumbling of it made no sense. And it also did really mess up the balance, if you can ever have a balance with a 10-person strong super team. You know what I mean? Like you can feel the labor of the many screenwriters or credited screenwriters trying to spread the offense and share the ball. It's not going to work. You know, it's just not possible.
Yeah.
There are too many scorers.
Her plot
team.
Line being basically like, there's something up with why she thinks she's from this other planet and everybody's dying. Like, what's going on with that? And like the, you know, disease that they claim.
Mad Weary. Where from you the have comics. To... not spelled the way I spell it when I tell you how I feel at the end of a day of childcare.
Mad Weary. I don't want to get too distracted by this, but I do want to ask you about it.
Yeah.
What did you think about the various points of actual human history represented in this movie?
Well, not a lot. I mean, again...
I thought it sucked.
I think that's fair. We do not have... These movies, or movies in general...
I thought the atomic bomb thing sucked. Yeah.
That was horrendous.
Yeah.
That was embarrassing.
And it was hard to get over, and I have to admit, like, no matter what happened in that movie, I would probably be like, fuck this movie for that. Kind of.
I agree with that. So the moment you're talking about, in case this is the moment you listening went to the bathroom, to understand why Fastos has turned his back on all of it, there is a absolutely gross and gratuitous little interlude where he is kneeling in the rubble of Hiroshima. By the way, how do Eternals travel? You know what I mean? Like, they're flying on Kingo's private jet, and yet they just seem to zip around the world. Is it just because they don't get bored over long flights because their lives are endless?
Right.
Anyway, kneeling in the rubble of Hiroshima being like, this is kind of my fault because I gave them a plow 6,000 years ago and this sucks. This is why there will never be a truly great, artistically great Marvel cinematic experience, because they can't do it. It cannot play in the real sandbox of life. It simply can't. The movie could not cash the check that it wanted to write, because baked into Jack Kirby's really out there ideas is that everything that humanity has achieved was nudged along by extraterrestrial help.
Right.
And that's been retconned over the years in comics to at times say that's why there are mutants in the X-Men in the Marvel Universe, or that's why we have superheroes at all on Earth in the Marvel Universe, because of Thanos has been retconned and apparently is going to be in the movies as well into being an Eternal. It's all because of this, you know, and the movie leans into it in ways that are intriguing, where the Celestial's name sounds, if you squint and mumble, it sounds a lot like an ancient Hebrew or Aramaic word for God.
Yeah.
The Eternals intentionally have names that are reminiscent of
mythological
Greek gods,
figures, yeah.
Which I'm here for that. I love the idea that the stories that live to this day are kind of, you know, whispered down the line over history, mutated versions of this. Like, that's kind of fun and cool, and the little references to King Arthur, or just thinking, oh, Makari sounds like Mercury, the speed god, you know, all that stuff is fun. Icarus flying into the sun. I love that. But then you get into this moral place that they cannot extricate themselves from, where they're like, well, did humans do this or did gods do this?
Right.
And this, so you end up with Phastos crying at Hiroshima, and you also end up with an argument that the movie doesn't actually want to linger on, which is the one that fuels the final conflict, which is it worth sacrificing an entire planet of Dane Whitman's in order to let billions other people live? That's heady.
Yeah.
That is, and not even, you know, I'm sure there are people on Red Pill YouTube being like, yeah, you know what I mean? The Icarus was right. But like, the movie can't go there.
Right.
It's the equivalent of the sex scene. It's like, we'll lie on a beach and maybe think that they're sexing, but let's move on quickly. And that's that. I agree with you. That is a bummer.
Well, it'll be interesting to see where it goes from here. Obviously, there's a couple of post-credit sequences that they promise the Eternals will continue.
Before we go into the future, can I just talk about Brian Tyree Henry for a second?
Sure.
Guys, I'm talking about Angelina Jolie as a national resource. Brian Tyree Henry is an international treasure. This guy is such a magical actor. He's such a beautiful actor. Like, he is just we talk about good acting, like people have access to the emotions. He apparently has like a tissue paper scrim between his public face and what is motivating his deepest heart. He is so compelling to me. I just love watching him act. And he bought me into this movie.
Yeah.
Because he loved his son so much. And, you know, I'm not so much of a cynic to think that it doesn't matter that he is a loving husband to a man and a father of a son in a Marvel movie that was designed to, you know, make millions in box office around the world. Like, I thought that was really significant. And I just thought his performance saved the movie for me, honestly. Once he was on the team, I was like, oh, okay, I'm rooting for them now. I want them to succeed.
I'm trying to get over like the Kit Harington situation.
Let's talk about it. I'm going to clear the space here because it's so weird. It's so weird.
He's in three scenes in the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
He shows up on FaceTime like once or twice.
To make jokes about King Midas.
And then is in a scene at the end of the film and in a stinger. So his entire presence in the movie is to set up, here's the spoiler if you guys don't know, to set up this his role as the Black Knight going forward, who has like a sword that can, what, destroy anything, but also kills you.
It's a cursed sword, and he's a long-running character. He's on the Avengers, et cetera, et cetera.
So maybe he's going to be part of like a new iteration of the Avengers with Blade or something. Like, that's cool. Like, I like it. But it is really crazy to see his journey from like, just like, well, like obviously carrying around Jon Snow like a lot of weight for a while, and then dipping his toe back into this and getting sucked into the whirlpool of, you better sign up for 9 more movies of this, my guy.
Well, also, he and Richard Madden, like Robb Stark and Jon Snow, switched personalities in this movie.
Yeah.
So maybe that was a fun acting exercise for them, where one was carrying the burden of the world and the other one was just like, hey, man, like I'm here to wear a coat. that is also a great example of why these movies cannot be great, which is everyone involved in writing and, frankly, designing, and I mean that affectionately, these movies, because they are architected or whatever, they weren't wrong to say that, like, if Cersei is going to be the heart of the movie, she needs to have some sort of love attachment, whether it's romantic or not, to humanity. And there needs to be someone to play that role. There needs to be a human figure. And then, you know, the bright boys on the 38th floor are like, but what if the boyfriend was an Avenger to be? Like, that's when you overthink it. And you're like, well, we could use this to triple backdoor a story that people don't even know they're getting yet. And so you have a character who fulfills no real purpose other than to hug Gemma Chan, which, by the way, great. That seems like a nice thing to be able to do. And then at the end is like, something I've been meaning to tell you about my cursed blade and my family's history. No, you weren't. Come on. That was silly. All this, like, a child trapped, who isn't a child, trapped in a child's body, that's wild shit.
Yeah.
That's a whole Blumhouse movie. Or not. It could go in so many different directions, and there's no room for it, you know? Like, Lauren Ridloff as Makari is a deaf superhero. She was awesome.
Yeah.
But what did...
The Lauren Ridloff-Barry Keoghan movie would have been cool. It would have been really cool.
and them in space. Great.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's talk about the larger connective pieces before we wrap up. I'm curious about what decisions were made about what to do with those stingers and when they were made. I think that, because there's a version of looking at this where it's Feige in his office watching the final director's cut of this and being like, shit. Like, we need to Guardians of the Galaxy this up stat. Yeah. And we need to give people a reason to care about any of this going forward. So we're going to bring in, I mean, Star Fox and Pip are not words I ever expected to say publicly as an adult. I know who they are, but I wasn't going to tell you guys that.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, that is definitely something I expected James Gunn to be like, now guess what? Oh, right. Yeah, we're doing it. But they're doing it in the most serious, po-faced Marvel movie of them all and casting the world's biggest pop star who has all the acting charisma of the world's teen pop star, as far as I could tell. No disrespect. It's well cast because the character is like an intergalactic sex celebrity. So that's clever.
He was
and
better,
funny.
I think, maybe cast as like a prick on the beach at Dunkirk than as the most, I mean, he is, but to some people, like the most charming person in the world. And I guess that's a good character for him to play if that's the case. The other one is, obviously, we've alluded to, is Kit Harington getting what a call from Blade, from Mahershala Ali.
Yeah, well, a call from behind him. The call's coming from inside the manor.
Exactly.
It's Mahershala Ali just dropping in for a little
voiceover.
I don't
know, man. I don't know. So we've got, like, Hawkeye is coming. I mean, we could do more State of Marvel stuff. We always do, but I thought this was like a very interesting failure that taught me a lot about myself as much as I learned about
the
Eternals.
What did you like? What did you like about it? And I'm not asking that to be a dick. I'm just curious because it's okay if it's not an interesting failure to you, if it's just a failure.
I thought that there were, it's easy to be like Barry Keoghan was good and I liked that. And Brian Tyree Henry is charming and I liked that. And I liked the idea of Icarus as this kind of double agent, but also like only I can see the truth here. So I have to lead humanity to its doom and then finds out he's wrong because of love and flies into the sun. Although I love all the like, is Icarus really dead posts that I'm seeing online. There are elements of it that I liked. I think that I have a little bit less interest in the cosmic and in the mythological when it comes to this stuff. I'm a little bit more of like a Hell's Kitchen guy who just wants to see like Daredevil punch a dude.
But you're right. And I think that this was, you know, it was interesting to see them test the limits of what this story can be. But I think that this fundamentally isn't what they do. You know, it just isn't what they do. And you can feel that in the struggle of the movie to kind of have coherent sense or to connect. It would have been better if they had never talked about Captain Rogers and Mr. Stark.
Sure.
Because it just opens up more questions. I mean, the beauty of the comics is that, especially in like the 60s and 70s and 80s, like Jack Kirby could do this. And it wasn't like Storm and Wolverine were like, what's that giant space god coming out of the Arctic Circle? They didn't know about it. Didn't matter. But that's not the storytelling project that Kevin Feige and Disney and the MCU are doing. It doesn't really work like this on the scale. And what you get instead is these awkward one-liners wedged into this, you know, and that's why I think there's that hard turn at the end of this into Guardians of the Galaxy stuff, where if you're floating around in space, it's all the Mos Eisley Cantina out there, man. It's all jokes.
Sure.
And maybe it's better for it.
We can wrap it up there. Andy and I will be back on Sunday night to talk about Succession. So we look forward to seeing you then. And then next week we'll be discussing, as we discussed, Mayor of Kingstown, Shrink Next Door, and hopefully we'll be joined by Sam Boyd from Love Life to talk about his show.
I'm also watching, I'm on Zoom, I'm watching Chris's face, and I think I want to talk a little bit more about Eternals next week because I have some like deeper Celestials I'd like to name check.
I love how much this brought something out of you. I wanted to clear out for you today.
Is it weird that I kind of loved parts of it? I don't know why.
No, I think that's cool. I think it's cool. I'm not trying to be like, this movie sucked. I'm just like, oh.
But it objectively often did. Like, I'm not arguing that. I just, man. Well, all right.
We were produced as always by Kai McMullen. We'll see you guys on Sunday night.
Kai is the real Eternal for putting up with us.
Seriously.
This episode is brought to you by Empower. You got money questions like, can I retire early? What are my best savings options? Can I afford to pay for my kids' education? Luckily, Empower has all the answers. With Empower's real-time dashboard and real live conversations, you get clarity on your real-life financial goals. So join 18 million Americans and Empower what's next. Start today at empower.com. Tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more. Sponsored by Empower, not an endorsement or a statement of satisfaction by a client. This episode is brought to you by Lincoln and the all-new 2024 Nautilus Hybrid, featuring a customizable 48-inch panoramic display, available Revel audio system, and available perfect position front seats with active motion massage. Oh my God, the world isn't wide enough. Visit Lincoln.com to learn more. Some models, trims, and features may not be available or may be subject to change. Check with your local retailer for current information. Lincoln and Nautilus are trademarks of Ford or its affiliates.